From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
The LAPD is a gang itself, you know, and they're just the biggest, best, and most organized gang in the city. But they are ganging themselves.
The video of four police officers beating Rodney King and their acquittal on April 29th, 1992, set off a week of violent civil unrest in Los Angeles. It cost dozens of lives and millions of dollars in damage.
The verdict in no way can be seen as justice, and I'm joined in that, in fact, by a range of even police officials from across the country and government officials.
This week on Latino USA, we look back to the urban uprising in Los Angeles, lessons learned in its aftermath. But first, this news. In 1992, rioting in the streets of Los Angeles sent racial shockwaves throughout the country. But anger and frustration weren't only expressed through violence, looting, and destruction. The cry for justice was also heard in music. 20 years later, the documentary film Uprising, Hip Hop and the LA Riots depicts the rage expressed through hip hop, along with interviews from rappers, musicians, police officers, including also Rodney King, all of these people who lived through the riots. Mark Ford is the film's director and executive producer. He joins us from our studios in Los Angeles. Welcome to Latino USA, Mark.
Thank you for having me.
During the past two decades, the riots have been documented and referenced in several films and songs. But what brought you to take on the documentary through hip-hop artists and the rage that they were expressing pre-riots?
Well, I had directed a documentary about NWA a few years ago called The World's Most Dangerous Group, and we were always curious what the impact of some of NWA's songs were on society at the time. And this was an opportunity with the 20th anniversary of the riots approaching to really dig in and examine the connection between hip-hop and social unrest. And I think what we found is that there was a pretty profound connection.
You open your documentary actually by speaking to Rodney King. Soon after that, you're hearing the voice of Snoop Dogg, who's the narrator of your documentary. And I think it's interesting when Snoop Dogg says, he says, people said they couldn't understand the rage. And yet hip hop was talking all about it before 1992.
It was really an exploration on our part to dig in and try to make people understand on a human level why people made those decisions. And hip hop really was conveying the truth emotionally about how a lot of people felt in South Los Angeles. It's just that, you know, mainstream American society wasn't paying attention, and the news media wasn't really stepping up to the plate to make everyone aware of a lot of the police abuses and the suffering that was going on in those communities. But, you know, hip hop was laser focused on a lot of these issues and really, you know, stepped up and conveyed that message. Unfortunately, it wasn't, you know, until a few years later that everybody really started listening.
You focus in your documentary with a lot of the African-American artists who are big names in hip hop. You don't really touch too much on the issue of Latinos in hip hop and how they were experiencing what happened in L.A. Post Rodney King's verdict. And has that story been told in terms of their presence in hip hop?
Absolutely. We actually tried to include a few tracks, some Cypress Hill tracks in particular, and actually tried to get a couple interviews, but we just couldn't make the timing, you know, work out. So they weren't included in the piece. But you know, Latino hip hop was absolutely speaking out about these issues at the same time. It's just that the people that ended up being able to sit down in the chairs weren't part of those groups.
So in your documentary, there's a soundbite that talks about how the LAPD in 1992, it was all about containment and suppression. And when you think about hip hop music now and you think about the reality of being, you know, young, black, Latino, post Trayvon Martin that happened just weeks ago, is there a sense that we have moved beyond this notion of containment and suppression?
You know, a lot of the people that were part of the uprising or the rebellion or the riot, whatever you want to call it, don't feel like all of the issues have been addressed and that there still is tension on the streets and that we should pay attention to it. Henry Watson in particular, who was, you know, one of the LA Four who was convicted of beating Reginald Denny, has a hard time apologizing and feeling like all is well with the world. He still is, you know, has some anger. This was a sentiment that was mimicked by others. There was a sense of no regret. I think it's worth examining that indeed there were abuses. There are still abuses, you know, going on in society. There's still racial profiling. There's still, you know, a lot of inequality among the social classes and the races, particularly in the city of Los Angeles. So I think a lot of the issues that were around and caused unrest still exist. Let's just hope that it never comes to this again.
Thanks for your work, Mark.
Thank you so much.
Mark Ford is the director and executive producer of Uprising, Hip Hop and the LA Riots. It airs May 1st on television's VH1 series, Rock Docs. For news updates throughout the week, visit us at latinousa.org or follow us on Twitter. We are LatinoUSA, all one word, and we're back in 30 segundos. That's 30 seconds. Stay with us. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. 20 years ago this month, the city of Los Angeles erupted in anger and in flames.
Let's look at all the smoke. Let's look like the world is coming to an end, you know? It's ridiculous.
Four policemen had been acquitted of savagely beating motorist Rodney King, who they'd stopped for speeding. Rage at the police acquittal and at the justice system brought the city to a halt. Joining us now to talk about those events in 1992 are two of the journalists who covered the unrest at the time. Both are still covering the city today. Héctor Tovar is a Los Angeles Times columnist who was part of the reporting team that won a Pulitzer Prize for its coverage in 1992. He joins us from the studios at KPCC in Pasadena. Welcome, Héctor.
Thank you very much.
And Cheryl Duvall was a reporter for National Public Radio. The NPR team received a DuPont Columbia Award for its coverage. Cheryl is now senior news editor for Southern California Public Radio. She's here at the NPR studios in New York with me. And welcome to you, Cheryl.
Thank you, Maria.
All right. So the verdict in the trial came down on the afternoon of April 29th, about 3:15. Then the wire service report stated that there was trouble at an intersection in South Central LA at Florence and Normandy Streets. And anytime you think about Florence and Normandy, you immediately remember these images of confrontations. But let's talk about the media coverage at that time. What did people see about the conflict? And let's start with you, Héctor. Were we getting an accurate picture?
Well, you were getting an accurate picture of the violence that was taking place on the streets. I think the rest of the country didn't know what Los Angeles was feeling then. It didn't know how we had been on edge for weeks watching this trial. It was one of the first trials that I can remember seeing in live coverage. And I think there was just this sense of shock, this sort of pit that we all felt in our stomachs of how could we be seeing this verdict? That is something that was very difficult for news to capture. That preceded that explosion on Florence and Normandy and some other intersections that weren't covered by television news helicopters.
I'm glad that you mentioned the helicopters, Héctor, because that was the image that a lot of people got, you know, from 15,000 feet up. A lot of the news media coverage was not street level.
So, Héctor, you talked about the fact that, you know, this was simmering, the pressure, the tension in L.A. was palpable. As a reporter, what was going on for you? I mean, you were having to cover this and you were seeing, yes, there was clearly racial tension, black, white. But tell me a little bit about what was going on for you as a Latino journalist at that moment.
Well, I was sent on the deadliest day of the riots, which was the second day. What I saw happen that day was kind of the sweep of American history condensed into a few hours. This event that had begun as an African-American reaction to an injustice rooted in a century of history and the fact that Black and Latino people live side by side as the poor people in Southern California, that became known to the rest of the United States, and it became this Latino poverty riot.
So, Cheryl, I find it interesting that Héctor calls what happened a poverty riot. But if you are seeing this from a question of race, what would be your interpretation of what was happening with Latinos and African Americans?
Well, I think that part of it was a reaction to more than a decade of disinvestment. Crenshaw Boulevard used to be auto dealerships and the site of the first modern shopping mall. And in the 80s, a lot of the investment went away. Korean Americans or recent Korean immigrants who did everything right. You know, they worked hard, their kids studied hard, they got into good schools, and they were the people who tended to own the liquor stores, the dry cleaners, the mom-and-pop grocery stores that sprung up in the absence of new investment. So everybody wanted to turn on the target closest to where they were, and it happened very often to be the Korean immigrants.
You know, one of the great observers of Los Angeles, Mike Davis, observed that the riot was three things: a black response to police brutality, a riot by poor Latino people who had been sort of left out of American prosperity in Los Angeles, and thirdly, a pogrom against Korean merchants, because there was this intense anger on the streets of South L.A. that went back to many incidents, but specifically there was the case of Latasha Harlins, a young girl who was shot by a Korean grocer in a dispute over a juice. And so there was definitely this vengeance. For me, the real irony was that people who had come to the United States seeking a country of abundance suddenly had this war break out all around them. People seeking a better life had come to realize how nothing was like the promise that they had imagined back home. And the riots drove home that message, so much so that in the years that followed, Latino immigration sort of made a right-hand turn from California and went into the rest of the United States. A lot of people who would have come to Los Angeles ended up in Kansas instead, or Georgia, or Virginia.
Fascinating. It's fascinating, that notion that it's true. After that time, there really was a right turn of Latino immigrants away from Los Angeles. So I wanted to ask the both of you about, I don't know, maybe it's the elephant in the room, which is that both of you are journalists of color. Hector, you're Latino. Cheryl, you're African-American. What was it to be a journalist of color in the mainstream?
Well, certainly a lot of the people on whose shoulders I stand in mainstream journalism had a similar call. Got a tap on the shoulder. You're black. You know how to speak jive. Get over there. And they became the front line of African-Americans in mainstream journalism. Luckily for me, and for Hector, I'm guessing too, the people who got that summons ran with it and did an amazing job.
There was a quiet riot that spread through not just newsrooms, but many American institutions in those days. I remember hearing from friends at universities about meetings that took place about race and about privilege, whose story was told and how it was told. All of those things, I think, quietly played themselves out.
So have we moved forward, or has it been the U.S. Mambo, three steps forward and two steps back?
Well, you know, I think that in many senses, Los Angeles is much more comfortable with its racial diversity today. My favorite taqueria now is a Korean taqueria.
Many, many people at ground level still feel stuck. And we as a city have not done enough, I think.
Cheryl Duvall here with me in the studio. Thank you so much for speaking with us on Latino USA.
El placer es mío.
Oh, thank you. And Hector Tobar in Los Angeles at the studios of KPCC, thank you for your work and for speaking with us on Latino USA today.
Thank you for having me.
The events of late April 1992 looked very different depending on where you were in the city. When the riots spread throughout several neighborhoods, South Central, Pico Union, Koreatown, many people in the rest of the country began to realize the many distinct communities that comprise Los Angeles. We spoke to several community leaders who were in the city during the disturbances. We asked them about their experiences and how their communities, the city, and the country have changed since.
My name is Yoon-hee Kim. I'm currently an international tea specialist. In 1992, I was a special advisor to then-Mayor Tom Bradley and also involved with the Black Korean Alliance. I myself am what is considered a 1.5 generation, came here as a 9-year-old with my first generation immigrant parents. And many of the Korean-American merchants were first-generation immigrants. They were not familiar with the cultures, with the way of customer relations, and often had language barriers. And so it was ripe for a lot of misunderstandings. On the 29th, the world stopped and then forever changed. That afternoon, the verdict was coming out. And along with much of Los Angeles, I could not believe the very words I was hearing. And then for 6.5 days, I did not leave City Hall. I ended up creating a makeshift emergency center out of my office on the mezzanine of City Hall. Eventually, someone brought a cot over so I could try to rest for a bit. Different people at times tried to have me drink a sip of water or eat something. By the 5th or 6th day, my entire lips had completely twisted from no sleep and no food. It was a 24/7 operation. And 20 years later, we've seen a lot of individual progress. Yet, for all of the promises that were made, many of the questions still go unanswered.
My name is Joe Hicks, and I'm the Vice President of Community Advocates, a small political think tank here in downtown Los Angeles. I was the executive director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. The organization was founded by Martin Luther King. I had been the co-chair of something called the Black Korean Alliance. Immediately in the aftermath was this attempt to get a handle on trying to deal with that rift that had taken place between the Korean community that was growing. Some community members and some community-based organizations didn't want some of those markets and liquor stores to regain their liquor licenses. The mayor's office became relatively politically dysfunctional in the aftermath of the riot. Unlike Detroit, you can still drive Detroit tomorrow, and you can actually see scars, burned out buildings from a riot that took place in that city in 1967. You can't do that in Los Angeles. And it means LA is in a very different place than it was 20 years ago. People had always routinely talked about South LA, Compton, Watts as the Black community. Folks clearly hadn't been paying much attention because even by the time the riots took place, Latinos had become a large part of that community. In fact, those communities are at least 70% Latino.
My name is Roberto Lovato. In 1992, I was working with the Central American Refugee Center. Now I'm a writer and co-founder of Presente.org. The riots marked the de facto beginning of the immigration wars in the United States. We started noticing that the Border Patrol had been called in to do, quote-unquote, security. The riots were really, I heard the term explosión social, which means social explosion. Everybody was talking about what happened as a uprising, and everybody's forgotten those neighborhoods in Los Angeles that are still neglected, still suffering under the boot of an economic crisis that started those riots in the first place, which was the crisis in the early 90s. You could see actually a thread that runs from April 29, 1992 to the present day Occupy movement as far as sending out police instead of actually responding to real human needs in inner cities.
We heard from Joe Hicks, Roberto Lovato, and Yoon-hee Kim remembering the LA riots of 1992. And in a minute, we continue looking back at the civil unrest in Los Angeles 20 years ago. We'll hear a poetic retelling of the events, and we'll look to the present, asking how this history resonates with teens who only know about Rodney King from their textbooks.
I believe they should have followed Martin Luther King's example. Organized protest would have been more feasible for that.
That's coming up on Latino USA. No se vayan. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Poet Juan Felipe Herrera was named California's Poet Laureate last month. Shortly after the disturbances in Los Angeles in 1992, Herrera wrote a set of poems reflecting on the events of the day. Here he is reading Rodney King, The Black Christ of Los Angeles, and All Our White Sins. Here's poet Juan Felipe Herrera.
The blue-black nightsticks came down to his plump flesh, across the face, the bones inside. The bones wavered into the heart, and they exploded for us. I am kneeling down. En Islos, la raza is contemplating Cinco de Mayo and the French skin that still covers our nakedness. A cloud with the face of W.E.B. Du Bois hangs over the Sherwin-Williams paint store. In South Central L.A., W.E.B. said the crisis of the 20th century would be the color line. Churn up more blackness through the windows. Two Chicanas run out of a busted mall, one loaded with a bag of Pampers, the other with loaves of bread. Beneath a harbor freeway bridge, a tired man who looks like Ho Chi Minh spits at the fire trucks going by. The liquor stores are ours. The laundries are ours. Shirts we never wore are finally pressed, ready for church, and the toasters with extra white slots are ours too. There is a pearl white Mercedes being kicked in by six kids with Adidas and torn faces. A bloody Chicano is taking pot shots at my neighbor, Taiji, as he swerves into an on-ramp going west. The guard is on the way. The federales are on the way. A cop shoots mace into a white boy's eyes. How does it feel? How does it? Sirens come for Rodney's spirit. Someone gets run over. The legs are crushed on Normandy Avenue. A young bato's brain slide down the headrest of his 59 Biscayne. On the way back from a soccer game, he met a bullet with his name. Rodney has answered all the silences. It is a tender voice, a cavernous tenderness. Greenish smoke curls toward Hollywood Boulevard. Edward James Olmos comes out to clean up with brooms. There is a crew of white students huddled in a hamburger diner called Burger Time. They are saying, blacks and minorities got their share already. Why are they doing this? Why, they say. And another newscaster uses the word animal as he peeks through the tube. And Rodney's white lawyer's face stretches as he becomes black in an uncanny way. He is looking for more words about justice. There is no black Christ. I said it to get myself going. I was loaded with stupor and complacency. Because I live in the suburbs of North Fresno. Because I see fat tractors and rigs smooth the ground for more cells of silence.
Juan Felipe Herrera is the new Poet Laureate of California. He teaches creative writing at the University of California at Riverside. Many young people today weren't even born when the LA riots took place. We wanted to find out what, if anything, they knew about them and what their thoughts were about the kind of civil unrest that took place then. So we sent Latino USA's senior producer, Carolina Gonzalez, to talk with some teens in Harlem, New York City.
We're at the Maisels Institute, where we met up with four young filmmakers who are part of the Teen Producers Academy. They're in the middle of working on a documentary about gun violence in Harlem, and took a minute to talk to us about what they thought about the LA riots.
No,
right, this is what we're going to talk about. I just wanted to get us to see it first, then we can talk.
I wouldn't expect such a big riot for Rodney King. I mean, even for Trayvon Martin or Sean Bell, they got shot. They're dead. And there was no riot. So honestly, I don't think I would have expected such a big thing.
So when is rioting an appropriate response?
Yeah, I don't think that rioting is ever going to be a good thing to do for something like this. I feel like people should find other ways to, like, fight against something bad that's going on. Like,
I have to disagree with you guys. Only because I read this book. It's by George Orwell. It's 1984. That's an extreme circumstance, but if the government was ever totalitarian, like the revolution in Egypt, I mean, I honestly felt they had every right to riot, but that's as a group collective. In the Rodney King riots, I believe they should have followed Martin Luther King's example. Organized protest would have been more feasible for that.
Yeah, in this scenario, it was a tantrum and a riot, but I don't think necessarily it's always going to be like that. And everyone has their own perspective. And there have been peaceful movements before. So, I mean, it's not always going to end up like the LA riots.
The people in LA who rioted for the Rodney King riots, a majority of them felt like they had no option left. It's a deep history within LA. I feel like it's a deep history within Black communities where, and minority communities in general, where they felt it was them against the police. And so when the video got out, they were bound to be mad. But if officers had been charged and not acquitted, they would have felt like justice is served.
I feel like there are moments and times, but probably more as a petition movement or something, but not necessarily like violence needs to be used.
The justice system wasn't on their side, so what else was there for them to do? They needed a leader that would force more constitutional action, and they didn't have that. And I feel that that was the main cause. They felt like the justice system failed them, and so they didn't feel like they had any other choice, even though they really did.
We heard from Brittany Lopez, Leonice Faust, Alejandro Rosario, and Keon Osby, all from the Teen Producers Academy at the Maisels Institute in Harlem, New York. And for this week, that's Latino USA. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, Deborah George, Nadia Raymond, Andres Caballero, and Michael Jones. We had help this week from Michael Johnson, KPCC, NPR New York, NPR LA, and Manoli Wetherill. Latino USA is produced by The Futuro Media Group, based in Harlem. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join me again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Pew Charitable Trusts, working for national energy policies to create jobs and spur investment at pewtrusts.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. And the Grantham Foundation, for the protection of the environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. This is NPR.